Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. All right. Usually when it comes to celebrating milestones, I try not to do the math because it makes me feel old these right. days. But let's do the math for this particular item invented 50 years ago. This curious box deciphered an arcane kind of code to offer shoppers a trip into the future. Any guesses?
No, what?
Well, I've read the article, so I'm
No guesses from you. From the Smithsonian, the supermarket scanner.
Oh, like a little UPC code. Okay.
That's all it. Right. Yeah, it's a very humble but ubiquitous technology that 50 years ago really kind of changed everything.
Yeah.
Specifically, it was the morning of June 26, 1974. It was an employee named Sharon Buchanan. She rang up a packet of Wrigley's Juicy Fruit chewing gum without ever having to key in a price. And this rectangular device was one of the store's 10 brand new Spectra Physics Model A's. Now, the shopper who bought the pack of gum was one Clyde Dawson. And he happened to be Marsh's head of development and research. So, along with executives at grocery stores across the country, he had been preparing for this big day since 1970, when the grocery industry started to study the possibilities of introducing barcode scanning into stores. Now, some shoppers and grocers clerks were skeptical about new tech. Uh-huh. A few customers missed the old hand-placed price tags on each product.
And sorry, where's the care? Where's the appreciation and the human touch?
You know, the individuality of the sticker being just slightly off, knowing that a human really put it on there. Well, listen, the checkout process was undeniably smoother as a result of the new tech. The store manager at Marsh's declared a victory for all shoppers. Quote, this system will eliminate cashier error, and it also ensures the customer that she is getting the full advantage of price breaks on items which are sold in multiples, which until that was spoken, I was like, yeah, I could see how that would be an issue trying to, like, you know, make sure that you've got the right amount for each quantity and
And asking the 17-year-old cashier to do percentages.
Oh, no. No, no, no.
Well, back then we may have been able to.
Yeah, true.
But as far as the price scanner goes, it was also good news for the barcode. Now, this had been a world-shifting idea, but it had been languishing since its invention in 1949.
Huh.
Now, the brainchild of Norman Joseph Woodland and Bernard Bob Silver, they were both engineering graduates of Philadelphia's Drexel Institute of Technology, they made the barcode from elongating Morse code vocabulary.
Okay.
So it's a binary, on, off, on, off.
Right, right. But it was inspired by Woodland's deep love of Morse as a Boy Scout. And it was a great invention, but it really hadn't been put to use until the arrival of the microcomputer and the creation of laser scanner technology. So it took until the 70s for even barcodes to really take off. Now, according to Hal Wallace, curator of electricity collections at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, each scanner was kind of a pain. They cost Marsh about $4,000, or in today's money, $25,000.
Oof.
That's not even inclusive of installation fees or ongoing training. And despite the daunting weight, it was encased in steel, it had chips and capacitors and copper transformers. Mostly, it contained air, because the main business happened in reflections and refractions of light, which do take space.
Mm.
So if you want to see the original 1974 scanner, it says it rests out of view in the National Museum of American History's electronic collection, but its descendants are all around us. All you have to do is go shopping.
Yeah, I mean, that's the next step, is self-checkout is now they don't need a cashier at all. They just need someone to go, do you want a bag? No. Okay, let me override this. Oh,
yes, put, take, yes.
Remove this item from the bagging area. You haven't.
The big question, too, is did he keep that package of gum and potentially sell it later? I mean, that's a big deal. It's a museum piece there he's got. Or did he just eat it?
Gross oversight by the Smithsonian's part. I have to agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in their gum department, they should have that.
Next link.
Next link.
We'll go back a little even further with this article from The Conversation, titled How the 18th Century Probability Revolution Fueled the Casino Gambling Craze.
Oh. Not where I thought that was going.
Right. So out of the supermarket and into the super casino, I guess. I mean, they weren't very super back then, but they were actually pretty stacked against players. I mean, they obviously still are, but much more back then. And this digs into some how math transformed the gambling world. So the first commercial gambling operations emerged, coincidentally or not, around the same time as the study of mathematical probabilities in the mid-1600s. Then in 1713, the brothers Johann and Jacob Bernoulli proved their golden theorem, which showed how it could actually be an advantage for the house to have a smaller edge over a larger one. So the law of large numbers refers to events governed by chance. When you flip a coin, for example, you have a 50% or even money chance of getting heads or tails. Were you to flip a coin 10 times, it's very possible that heads will turn up 7 times, but after 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 flips, the ratio of heads to tails will be closer and closer to the mathematical mean of probability, that is, half heads and half tails. Over time, someone with even the smallest statistical edge would eventually win almost all of the money that was staked, and this is what happens in roulette. Imagine 10 players with $100 apiece, half of them bet $10 on red and the other half bet $10 on black. Assuming that the wheel strictly aligns with the mean of probability, the house will break even for 18 of 19 spins. But on the 19th spin, the ball will land on one of the green house numbers, allowing the house to collect all the money staked from all bettors. So, after 100 spins, the house will have won half of the player's money. After 200 spins, they'll have won all of it. But gambling operators were slow to adopt these findings. Instead, they played it safe by promoting games with long odds. One was the Royal Oak Lottery, a game played with a polyhedral die with 32 faces like a soccer ball. Players could bet on individual numbers or combinations of 2 or 4 numbers, giving them at best 7-to-1 odds of winning. Public outcry against the Royal Oak Lottery was such that the Lottery Act of 1699 banned it, on the grounds that the odds of winning or losing were not readily apparent to players. Further statutes outlawed games of chance played with dice, cards, wheels, or any other device featuring numbers or figures. And since this language did not explicitly include letters, the game of EO, standing for even odd, was introduced in the mid-1740s after the last of these gambling statutes was enacted. It was played on a wheel with 40 slots, all but 2 of which were marked either E or O. As in roulette, an ivory ball was rolled along the edge of the wheel as it was spun. EO's defenders could argue that it was not an unlawful lottery because the odds of winning or losing were now readily apparent to players and appeared to be virtually equal. Although this logic might not stand up in court, overburdened law enforcement was happy for a reason to look the other way, and EO proliferated. After EO appeared in Britain, gambling operations both there and on the continent of Europe introduced even money betting options into both new and established games. But the Victorian ethos of morality and respectability eventually won out. Parliament outlawed games of chance played for money in public or private in 1845, restrictions that were not lifted until 1960. By 1845, however, British gamblers could travel by steamship and train to one of the many European resorts cropping up across the continent, where the probability revolution had transformed casino gambling into the formidable business enterprise it is today. So, they tried, but, you know.
Respectability can only get you so far. People want to gamble.
Yeah, and people will go further, like across the ocean.
Right.
And make up any game to gamble.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you could use dots, you could draw animals on...
I really want to see, like, Pictionary poker now, where it's like certain figures, but people, the stakes are high.
It was an emu. How could you not see that it was an emu?
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, I don't have a great transition, but this is from The Guardian. The simple trick that can sabotage your critical thinking. So let's talk about thought terminating cliches. Something like the house always wins. There you go. There's your
nice.
Coined in 1961 by psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, it describes a catchy phrase aimed at shutting down or bypassing independent thinking or questioning. We've even heard plenty of these in everyday expressions. Like, they've worked their way down to it is what it is. Boys will be boys. Everything happens for a reason, right? Yeah. In his book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, Lifton wrote that these semantic stop signs compress the most far-reaching and complex of human problems into brief, highly selective, definitive-sounding phrases easily memorized and easily expressed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like what you're telling me is it isn't what it is, which is actually great news, honestly.
Right. And right, we are definitely in a golden era of these kind of catchphrases, but it's not unique to English. It's pervasive everywhere. The article lists a bunch of foreign language examples that I will only botch, but I can do their English translations. China has a phrase that amounts to no solution or there's nothing that can be done, justifying inaction. Japan also has a catchphrase that equates to it is what it is. The Polish have a phrase, people in positions of power can get away with anything. Thought-terminating cliches commonly carry a defeatist flavor. Mm. It's hard work to figure out what's the best way to think about complex subjects, such as climate policy or geopolitics. You just got to keep on living. L-I-V-I-N. Tobias Bampidi, a decision scientist at the University of Geneva, argues that such phrases become especially problematic when wielded by politicians with decision-making powers. Fairly obvious. In 2023, Australian conservatives use a rhyming slogan, if you don't know, vote no, to discourage citizens from supporting a constitutional amendment that would have afforded Indigenous people representation in Parliament. Spampati says disinformation tends to spike around major events like elections, climate change, OJ trials.
I was going to say, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit, man.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, mere awareness of such tricks isn't always enough to help us resist their influence. For this, we can blame the illusionary truth effect, a cognitive bias defined by the unconscious and yet pervasive tendency to trust a statement simply because we've heard it multiple times. Memory scientist Lisa Fazio has found that we are so primed to confuse the statement's familiarity with veracity that the bias persists even when listeners are warned to look out for it, even when they are explicitly told the source was untrustworthy.
Yeah. The more times you hear it, the more you can't unhear it. It's right there in your head.
Plus, if it's hard and uncomfortable to think about complex things that have no easy solution, suddenly your brain has a little hit of dopamine of like, that was a nice rhymey phrase. Okay, I feel better. Let's just move on now.
Yeah, and when we hear a piece of information over and over again, it's a sign it's come from multiple sources. It must likely be true, right? But sometimes it is. Like, stop, drop, and roll if you're on fire. I'm pretty sure that's still true.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I haven't been on fire in a long time. I haven't questioned my preset, so...
So of the many cognitive biases that silently govern our decision-making, that illusionary truth effect is one of the most potent. There's really no way to prevent or combat it. So it is what it is, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's really defeatist right there.
Next link.
All right, well, we're about to find out how old everybody is. Uh-oh. Did you take typing in school?
Yes.
Way?
No.
The generational divide has been opened.
That's all right. I technically did. What I had was a one semester class called microcomputer applications. And the first 6 weeks of that was touch typing, as they used to call it, after which we moved on to more important things like Microsoft Paint.
I got to program in BASIC back when I was in California public education system.
Oh, well, that's the difference, because California is way better than Texas. I went to public school here.
We did Logo. That would be 1980s. Oh, nice. Yeah.
That must have been Perot's program.
Probably. Yeah, likely. It was in Dallas, so that's that tracks.
But it is a fact that kids these days generally don't learn typing in school at all because they're all on screens by the time they're two, and it's just assumed that they're going to pick it up on their own. And if you look at it, the generational transition there was actually insanely quick, where you've got hundreds of years of students learning penmanship as its own very important subject. Then you start to see cursive dropping out just as typing is introduced. And within just a couple of decades, they're at the point where there's genuinely very little handwritten work in school at all. And it probably won't surprise you to learn, given all this lead up, that this is probably a bad thing. Or, as NPR puts it, why writing by hand beats typing for thinking and learning.
Ah, that particular application, I can vouch for that, too.
Yeah, well, because studies have shown that when young children are learning the alphabet, physically tracing their ABCs leads to better and longer lasting recognition of those letters. And they say it's precisely because kids' handwriting is messy and each letter A looks a little different. So they're gaining a more general understanding of what constitutes an A, whereas kids who learn by typewritten fonts tend to be more literal about, only that exact thing is a letter A, right?
Ooh, yeah. So it's almost like you get to accumulate an average of things to get to the Platonic ideal, which sticks better. I always thought it had to do with like muscle memory.
Well, that plays a role too.
Okay.
Yeah, that absolutely plays a role. But they've done studies where it's like the kids aren't even the ones writing it. They're just looking at handwritten samples. And that awareness also applies to word recognition and recall. Kids who have learned their vocabulary through handwritten examples are able to bring those words to mind much better than kids who have learned them in a perfectly consistent typeface. And, you know, like you said, once you get into the neurological effects of doing the physical writing yourself, it gets even more compelling because, you know, the neurons involved in handwriting are immense compared to what's needed for a single tap on a keyboard. Not only is each individual finger having to exert different pressures at the same time, but your visual system also has to be engaged in order to judge what you're doing and provide feedback for finger adjustments. And that's a really important element, apparently, because, you know, one of the signs of being a good typer is that you can do it without looking, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But
that's me.
You actually want to be engaging those visual neurons because it strengthens them for other tasks. And that's kind of the whole takeaway here, is that handwriting is important not because it's handwriting, but because it fundamentally strengthens a developing brain in ways that it might not be possible to get back once you've exited those critical development windows. There is, for example, a well-known connection between handwriting and emotional states that some scientists are starting to think goes both ways. Like if you don't do enough fine motor practice in kindergarten, you might be setting yourself up for a lifetime of mental health struggles because you never built those underlying brain structures for patience and evaluation and self-control. And that's exactly why you're starting to see fine motor work being implemented as a form of therapy for adults, like adult coloring books. And some school districts are starting to recognize this as well, but they seem to be coming at it from the wrong angle. This past year, for example, the state of California began once again requiring all students to learn cursive. And similar bills are moving through the legislature in Indiana, Kentucky, South Carolina, and Wisconsin. But studies have indicated that neurologically, there is no added benefit to cursive over print. And in fact, there's no added benefit to using pen and paper versus using a stylus on a screen. What matters is the engagement of the fine motor and visual systems together. And it's possible that schools would do better just focusing on improving a student's printing rather than, you know, derailing everything with a whole new written system in the middle of elementary school. Sorry, in case it wasn't clear, I hated cursive as a child. And also, I'm not exactly a paragon of mental stability, so it adds up. Next link.
Next link.
All right. This is about a rat purge saving an island from the Atlantic because... Look, if you just want to revive a seabird paradise, all you got to do is eliminate the rodents. Boom.
Huh.
Well, maybe not quite boom, but the last rat on Tromelin Island, which is a small teardrop of scrubby sand in the Western Indian Ocean near Madagascar, that last rat was killed in 2005. And that's kind of a big deal because rats had lived on the island for hundreds of rat generations. They likely arrived in the late 1700s when a French ship carrying slaves wrecked there. They're thinking it was probably home to at least 8 different seabird species at the time, including hundreds of thousands of delightfully named birds, including frigate birds, terns, and boobies. But then the rodents arrived. And like on countless other islands around the world, the rats ate their way through those birds' eggs, eventually decimating the populations.
I was thinking it was a food supply thing. I didn't realize rats ate bird eggs. That's interesting.
I mean, it is a food supply thing. It's just that food supply grows up to be a...
another bird.
Right.
And by 2005, when researchers and French authorities finally began eradicating the rodents, only 2 bird species were left, a few hundred pairs of masked and red-footed boobies. But today, nearly 2 decades after authorities banished the rats, nice word choice there, Tromelin Island is once again a thriving seabird paradise, home to thousands of breeding pairs belonging to 7 different species, which is great. Now, ridding a landscape of invaders is one of the main challenges to reestablishing seabird colonies worldwide. Holly Jones, an ecologist at Northern Illinois University, who was not involved with the paper, said, look, we have the technology. We've been doing this since 1950. And according to a 2022 review, about 88% of efforts to eliminate invasive vertebrates from islands succeeded from 1900 to 2020. Back on Tromelin Island, which is, it's small, okay? It's only 1 square kilometer, and it's uninhabited except for a small scientific research station. And they did it in a month using poisoned bait. Now, after the predators are gone, researchers may need to help seabird communities on some islands recover. That may involve restoring vegetation. Sometimes it involves placing life-size models of birds on the island. I think we've talked about this before. Like, hey, everything's cool here. You know, playing the sounds of coral reefs like, oh, it's bustling and busy here.
Right, right.
But seabird edition. And yeah, they've even played recorded calls to lure them in. But for Tromelin Island, nah, didn't need to do it because the seabirds didn't need the help. By 2013, populations of both of the boobies, the red-footed and masked, they had more than doubled, and then soon after, we started seeing white terns, brown noddies, wedge-tailed shearwaters, and lesser noddies. All of these seabirds have started showing back up. They're thinking that Tromelin Island's recovery was quick in part because the seabird community is mostly dominated by species that regularly disperse to new homes. But some species are slower to bounce back. For example, albatrosses, petrels, and other seabirds, they tend to remain loyal to one breeding spot. They rarely try new locations, even if birds from the same species have lived there before. And so those seabird communities, we may need to bring out the life-size dolls and the recordings of, like, it's all good here.
Yeah, I mean, you get too many pretty birds on the island, that just means the tourists are going to come. And then it'll be a different invasive species.
Hey, listen, as long as we're not mowing through their eggs, I'm sure we can strike a happy balance.
That's right. We can have some selfies as long as we don't eat their babies.
And then now there's too many birds.
That's right. That's right. Now it's a problem.
Well, we've got a lot of domestic house cats that would relish the job. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from ArsTechnica.com, and it's titled Family Stricken with Rare Brain Worms After Eating Undercooked Bear.
Okay, well, never mind. I was horrified, and then the judgment kicked in, and I was like,
Yeah, in this scenario, you know, the thought terminating cliche is a literal brainworm.
Right.
So, sorry. They're all okay, so it's fine. They all recovered. Okay. So, in the summer of 2022, a family gathered in South Dakota for a reunion that included a special meal, kebabs made with the meat of a black bear that one of the family members had, quote-unquote, harvested from northern Saskatchewan, Canada, that May. Lacking a meat thermometer, the family assessed the doneness of the dark-colored meat by eye. At first, they accidentally served it rare, which a few family members noticed before a decision was made to recook it. They tried once, at least. The rest of the reunion was unremarkable, and the family members departed to their homes in Arizona, Minnesota, and South Dakota. But just days later, family members began falling ill. One, a 29-year-old male in Minnesota, sought care for a mysterious illness marked by fever, severe muscle pains, swelling around his eyes, or periorbital edema, high levels of infection-fighting white blood cells, also called eosinophilia, a common response to parasites, and other laboratory anomalies. The man sought care 4 times and was hospitalized twice in a 17-day span in July. It wasn't until his second hospitalization that doctors learned about the bear meat, and then it all made sense.
Then they were pissed.
Yeah.
You waited this long to tell me?
Yeah. The doctors suspected the man had a condition called trichinellosis, an infection of trichinella nematodes, or roundworms. These dangerous parasites can be found worldwide embedded into the muscle fibers of various carnivores and omnivores, according to the CDC. But it's quite rare to find them in humans in North America. Between 2016 and 2022, there were 7 outbreaks of trichinellosis in the U.S. involving just 35 cases. The majority were linked to eating bear meat, but moose and wild boar meat are also common sources. Once eaten, larvae encased in the meat are released and begin to invade the small intestines. And buckle in. We're going to get descriptive here. Causing pain, diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting. Then the larvae develop into adults in the gut. They mate and produce more larvae there. The second generation of worms then go wandering through the lymphatic system, into the blood, and then throughout the body, which is the systemic phase. The larvae can end up all over, reaching skeletal muscles, the heart, and the brain, which is rich in oxygen. The man's symptoms fit the case, and several tests confirm the parasitic infection. Of 8 interviewed family members present for the bear meat meal, 6 people had illnesses matching trichinellosis, ranging in age from 12 to 62. And 3 of them were hospitalized, including the 12-year-old, unfortunately. 4 of the 6 sickened people had eaten the bear meat, while 2 only ate vegetables that were cooked alongside the meat and cross-contaminated.
Yikes!
Wow.
Yeah, so do not mess around.
Yeah, vegans being picky about different utensils to prepare food. No, 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 they're onto something here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Experts at the CDC obtained leftover frozen samples of the bear meat, which revealed moving larvae.
Okay.
Testing identified the worm as Trichinella nativa, a species that is resistant to freezing. In an outbreak study published Thursday in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, great cheerful name there, health officials from Minnesota and the CDC reported that the 3 hospitalized patients were treated with the anti-parasitic drug albendazole and recovered. The remaining 3 cases fortunately recovered without treatment. The health experts noted how tricky it can be to identify and diagnose these rare cases, but flagged periorbital edema and the eosinophilia as being key clinical clues to the grisly infections. And above all, people who are going to eat wild game meat should invest in a meat thermometer and make sure the meat is cooked to at least over 165 degrees Fahrenheit or 74 degrees Celsius to avoid risking brain worms.
And if you go to the hospital, mention that you've eaten raw bear meat.
Yes.
Like, you know, that's part of the history.
Maybe lead with that.
Yeah.
Nauseous.
Yeah. I mean, it's just best not to eat the meat, you know, from the bear that you shot yourself.
No.
I mean.
Well, and I'm starting to wonder if they used the word harvested because they didn't hunt it. It was like roadkill. And they were like, ooh, let's take this.
Oh,
yeah. It's in scare quotes in the article, too. So
they ran it over. They ran it over and didn't know what to do with it. So they put it in the back of their pickup.
And 6 hours later, they froze it. And
yeah. Anyways, next link.
Next link.
Well, this might be a partial solve. This comes from neuroscience.news.com. Mind-blowing head transplant system with robotic surgeons and AI precision.
Oh, wow.
You know, that may not have been the bombastic adjective they wanted to use in this example.
Mind-blowing? No, I don't know if they meant it. It didn't feel like they meant it, honestly. So in a bold move that pushes the boundaries of, let's say, medical science, BrainBridge, a neuroscience and biomedical engineering startup, has unveiled a groundbreaking concept for a, quote, head transplant system. Though still just in the conceptual phase, the company's vision is to develop a fully automated robotic system capable of performing the complex procedure within the next 8 years.
I don't think that's going to happen.
But that's what the venture capital has reported.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like something you put on the PowerPoint to get your seed funding, but you're not actually going to pull that
for
off.
8 years, right. So it goes without saying that the potential positive and negative implications of the tech are massive. So BrainBridge envisions a future where patients with otherwise untreatable conditions could receive a new lease on life through a whole body transplant, essentially replacing their diseased and damaged bodies with healthy ones.
That's a lie. It's for the rich who can afford it.
Well, and where do they get those bodies?
Yeah, where are you going to get a body? That's a really important question.
We're not going to talk about that part.
Ooh, hey, yeah.
The process, as demonstrated in a recently released video, all CG, don't worry, involves a sophisticated robotic system that would simultaneously remove the heads of both the donor and recipient, then seamlessly transfer the recipient's head onto the donor's body. Kind of like the titular classic movie, Face Off.
Dang it! That was what I was going to say.
Sorry, did I beat you there?
In the video, are they using Nick Cage and John Travolta's face as the examples? Okay.
Do the whole head. The procedure would be guided by AI, of course, and real-time molecular level imaging, ensuring precise reconnection of the spinal cord, nerves, and blood vessels. There's a small challenge in realizing this concept. The current inability to fully repair nerve and spinal cord damage. That's small.
Yeah.
to their credit, at least they acknowledge this and are actively recruiting specialists in various fields. So, hey, you out there, contact BrainBridge. In the long term, the company aims to revolutionize healthcare as we know it, whatever that means.
I'm glad they didn't say, like, we're here to disrupt death or something equally dumb.
That would be worse. You're right.
So, of course, this isn't new. We've actually had other doctors, I threw that in air quotes that you can't see, attempt this before. I'll spare you all the gory details, but it was tried once in the 50s with a two-headed dog. In the 1970s with a monkey, which I have seen the pictures,
and
it's
no.
as sad as it sounds. Yeah. More recently, controversial neurosurgeon Sergio Canavero claimed to have successfully performed a human head transplant, although both the donor and recipient were deceased. So I don't know if I could call that successful.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I can sew a button on. I could do two heads of corpses. It's the keeping them alive part that's hard. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include: fish are adapting to weightlessness on the Chinese space station, don't let a bird's feathers fool you, and soldiers put an ancient Greek suit of armor to the test. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on daminteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/daminteresting week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.